Randy Isaac is the a solid state physics research scientist, or formerly in a former life, that was what you were. He is currently the executive director of the ESA, where he has been a member since 1976 and a fellow since 1996. He received his bachelor's degree from Wheaton College in Illinois and his doctorate in physics from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He joined IBM to work at the Thomas J. Watson Research Center in 1977, and most recently served as the VP of Systems Technology and Science for the company. He sponsored IBM's Blue Gene, is that right?
Yeah.
Blue Gene, did you come up with the name?
Yeah.
Did you invented the name?
No.
Oh. The Blue Gene Supercomputer Technology, which won the 2009 National Medal of Technology. He's also a member of the AAAS and a senior member of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, and a fellow of the American Physical Society. And Ray and I have had many wonderful times, breakfast, where we teach each other about our own fields, respective fields, physics and biology. So I'm glad to be able to introduce you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Craig. Appreciate it. Hey, that was a great presentation by Walter. And I have quite a challenge here to argue the opposite side. Walter has told you why the cosmological constants constitute evidence for the existence of God, and I will argue the opposite. Now, that's a harder challenge here tonight, I think, because most of you may be predisposed to think that God exists, and hey, this all makes sense. Whereas last night and the night before at Brown and then at Harvard, I think the majority of the audience was predisposed to say, no, there is no evidence for the existence of God. So it was a little easier for me. So I've got a challenge here tonight. I should point out that at Harvard, there's some interesting feedback. You notice that Walter very subtly, you know, changed the title of the talk, you know, from the mystery of the cosmological constants to fine-tuning. And one of the people at Harvard pointed out, well, doesn't that presuppose the answer? Fine-tuning is an action verb, and so it kind of presupposes that there's a subject, someone that does the acting. Good point. And someone else pointed out that fine-tuning might also imply that it's an act later in time, following an initial act. And we scratched our heads, but then most of us who remember the days of the initial tuners and lock and amplifiers recall that there was a tuning knob and a second fine-tuning knob. So you would first do the primary tuning and then do the fine-tuning. So it's always the second task after you do the initial tuning. So he said there were some implications there. But we had a lot of great discussions, a lot of different views that came out, and we enjoyed that. So I'm looking forward to tonight here to having a perhaps a slightly different slant. Looking forward to hearing some of your perspectives. So Walter's basically told you what the cosmological constants are all about, so I won't repeat any of that. But we need to examine the argument that he presented in terms of why does this present evidence for the existence of God. Now, first of all, I'd like to point out that if all we allow ourselves to consider is scientific evidence, that that's the sphere of what we can do, science only, and that's what I would say is scientism. Like Walter's slide on scientism is one area where I disagree with him, but that's a different topic. We can talk about that later. But Ian Hutchinson was here, I think, at one of these meetings and talked about scientism as saying that all knowledge is scientific, and only scientific knowledge is real knowledge. So if we work within that scope, I think it's fairly easy to see that starting from the cosmological constants and their amazingly precise values, that we would have a hard time coming to evidence for the existence of God. And why is that? Well, if you think about it, what do we know about how these cosmological constants acquired their values? How did the speed of light come to be its particular value? How did the mass of the electron come to have its value? Well, it's probably easy enough for us to imagine that a really good and distinguished mechanical engineer like Walter might go to his machine shop, and he's there crafting his universe, and he grinds and he polishes and sands the different values to be very precise. Well, to get the kind of precision that he's talked about, that'd be pretty tough to do. Or maybe he has to run to the stock room, and he'll look at the inventory of all possible real numbers, pretty well an infinite set, and you kind of pick one and say, oh, I'll take this one. And it turns out if he hadn't picked that particular one, then we wouldn't exist. Or maybe you might imagine a piano tuner, you know, kind of tighten all the different strings in just the right way. And again, that kind of presupposes somebody's doing this tuning. Or maybe somebody's just throwing the cosmic dice. Maybe there's, like Roger Penrose said, 10 to the 132 kind of possibilities. But when you think about it, none of these carry a lot of weight. I mean, they're all anthropomorphisms. It's kind of our way of thinking of things, almost certainly not correct. After all, we don't even know when these constants acquired their values. People debate that in the field. Was it at the moment of the Big Bang? Was it a Planck's time constant afterwards? Was it a little bit later? We don't really know. And when you don't know mechanisms of how something happened, you can't really even know what ballpark you're in on probabilities. I mean, we have no idea. Maybe these constants are all quantized. Maybe they're only one value. Maybe they're all related. Maybe they're interdependent. The point is, we don't know. And I would suggest that scientific ignorance is not evidence for anything. Now, another point here is that we're trying to look at a type of causality. And we should really have a long discussion of what causality is. But foregoing all that, the claim that Walter made really was that the cause of the cosmological constants having their values, you know, is God. That's a causal agent. But if you look at what philosophers of science are saying, that if you're doing historical causal analysis, then, which means that you're taking a phenomenon that happened historically and you're trying to relate it to a causal factor, they say that you must be able to show independently that that causal agent actually existed and that it had the ability of creating that phenomenon. Now, again, as long as we're staying within the scientific methodology, you don't have the independent evidence for God. That's what you're trying to find. And so suddenly you realize that a phenomenon that we don't know much about can't really provide us evidence for a causal agent about whom we know nothing otherwise. So we really don't get very far as long as we talk about science only. So that means we have to broaden our horizons. And this is where the fun, it gets to be fun, right? Let's go ahead and presuppose, and in this audience it may not be too hard, let's presuppose that God exists. And let's presuppose that he does have the ability to create the phenomenon, namely the precise values of the cosmological constants. Yeah, it kind of sounds like we're already presupposing the answer, kind of, but bear with me because this is going to play out a little bit. So if we make that presupposition, then, of course, the philosophers of science will say, okay, you can work with that. Let's proceed a little bit. Okay, but in that scenario, what really is the argument that Walter is making? Okay. Now, I'll restate it in a different way, and he may have little problems with this, but it seems to me that the way he's structuring the argument is essentially comes down to saying, we cannot explain why the cosmological constants have those precise, amazingly precise values. Therefore, God is the relevant explanation. Now, he said it in a much more elaborate, sophisticated way, but that's essentially what I hear him say. Now, Walter clearly agrees with me, and he said many of the things that I would say, and we agree very much here, that's a form of argument which is troublesome. And what I'll get to is that the difference between Walter and me is whether this kind of reasoning is really what's going on. Is it applicable or not? And Walter says no, and I will say yes. But we'll get to that in a minute. First of all, let me dig a little deeper as to why I think that kind of reasoning is wrong. And what do I mean by that kind of reasoning? The kind of reasoning that says we cannot explain scientifically, we cannot explain this phenomenon scientifically, therefore the proper explanation is God. Okay, where does that kind of thinking come from? Because I would like to say that I believe this is pervasive in our society and is one of the problems in the conflicts between science and faith. Because what he's really saying is that there is a competition between scientific explanations and theological explanations, that the two are mutually exclusive, that you can say when there isn't a scientific explanation, then there is a theological explanation, and the absence of one is evidence for the other. Now, where did those kind of notions come from? Well, historian Mark Knoll claims that this kind of thinking dates back to the 13th century, or at least has its roots back there, and it's been filtered down since then. Now, when it comes to 13th century philosophy, most of you know Thomas Aquinas, but there are two others that are relevant in this case. One is William of Ockham. He gave us Occam's razor, that law of parsimony that says that competing explanations for a phenomenon, it is the simplest one that is correct. You must choose the simplest one. And the other philosopher of note is John Duns Scotus. I'm sure you read him every day, don't you? John Duns Scotus, back in the 13th century, gave us the concept of a single essence of being. What in the world does that mean? Well, he was trying to tell us that God is really the single essence of being, and that's the only essence there is. So any characteristic of anything else in the universe, you know, is of the same essence as God's. Example, God is good. Okay, God's goodness is a particular characteristic of God. Now, do humans have goodness? Are they good? Well, he says human goodness is of the same essence, must be of the same essence as God's goodness. It's called univocity of being, one voice. It's the same thing. It differs only in degree and not in kind. Okay? So human goodness differs in degree from God's goodness, but it's still the same kind. Now, Mark Knoll says that this filtered down to the scientific era and was applied in a way where we have a univocity of causality. That is to say that when God causes a phenomenon, it's of the same essence as a natural explanation, the force of gravity, or electromagnetic forces, that these notions of causality are of the same essence. And now, Martin Knoll says, you combine that with Occam's razor, and that implies that you can't have them both. And that's been distorted a bit in our society to saying you can't have them both, so it's got to be one or the other. And that's where our society seems to get this notion that scientific explanations compete with theological explanations. Now, this is something that you and I and all of us kind of feel and we often say and hear in our daily lives. I mean, how often have you heard it said, you know, you scientists, you can't explain love. That means there must be a God. You can't explain altruism. There must be a God. You can't explain the origin of the Big Bang. There must be a God. You can't explain the origin of life. It must be a God. You can't explain the origin of consciousness. There must be a God. And we do that in our daily lives. You have a close call on an accident. I can't explain how that happened. It must have been God. Don't we do that every day? That's my natural reaction. It says, I can't explain this. It must be God. Well, what are we doing when we're saying that? We're really saying that it's our ignorance that points to God, something that we do not understand. And it's not just we theists who do this. Atheists are very strong using the inverse. They love to say, aha, I've got a scientific explanation, therefore there is no God. Look at all the things that in the last 200 years that used to be attributed to God, we now have an explanation for. Hey, there is no God. Steve Hawking says, we now know the Big Bang came out of the quantum fluctuations of a vacuum. Hey, there is no God. And this is the core of a lot of the atheist writing. We will show you that we have scientific explanation. We're confident we'll explain the origin of life very soon. Therefore, there is no God. And it goes on and on. And I would suggest that the two authors that wrote the suggested reading that Walter already mentioned, that they're doing the same thing. Because if you read those chapters and the whole books, what they're really saying is there is room for God because the scientific explanations are not compelling. The scientific explanations have no data or do not have enough data to support them. So there's room for God. Now, the implication, they don't say this, but the implication is that if there were data to support them, if you did have a compelling scientific explanation, then there wouldn't be room for God. See the point? So if you want to get fancy and multisyllabic, you call this the fallacy of the univocity of causality. Okay, try to say that real fast. What it really means is that it's fundamentally wrong to hold these in competition. Okay. Well, what's the alternative? Well, if you now back off and say, well, where did we go wrong? I think the key part is in demanding this univocity or the single essence of causality between natural causes and theological causes. And instead, what I think is the predominant theme in science and religion over the last at least half century, maybe much longer, is that these causes are not of the same kind, but they are complementary. Okay? And so you have complementary causes. They no longer compete directly. Okay? And therefore, you don't have to pick. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that they're unrelated. They're not the non-overlapping magisteria that Stephen Jay Gould said, because they are connected. Walter gave the excellent example of this, of the water boiling for a cup of coffee. But the two kinds of explanations have to be connected, otherwise they're meaningless. Because whoever wanted the cup of coffee would have to be able to turn on the switch to be able to get the current flowing. If there was no capability of turning that switch on, then the two would be independent events, and you couldn't really say that it's a legitimate cause. So they are related. They're not completely independent. But nevertheless, they're of different kinds and therefore can coexist. And they're not competing. Now, that seems pretty obvious, and you can all agree with that. Now, what does that mean, though, if you carry it to its consequences? It kind of means that you kind of lost this whole key pillar of scientific apologetics where you can point as evidence to the existence of God from all these things that we can't explain. You've kind of taken that pillar of scientific apologetics away, okay, on all fronts. So, that line of thinking then says that the absence of a scientific explanation is not really evidence for the existence of God. What does that tell you about science? It then implies that science itself is of an agnostic nature. It really doesn't support theism or atheism. Now, Walter and I have known each other very long, and I know that he agrees with all of this. Okay, so why is it that we kind of still come to the wrong point? And I think this is a very important area of discussion. Because he brought up mechanisms versus agency, and this is kind of an important point that we kind of need to get to in terms of where do you apply this kind of thinking and what is competitive and what isn't. And I know that much of the intelligent design community takes great pains to say, hey, we're not talking about a God of the gaps. We're not talking about this kind of mutual exclusivity. We're talking about something which is representative and indicative of agency as opposed to mechanism, and therefore we avoid this fallacy of the univocity of causality. But is it really true? Okay. Now, much of the community focuses on information as being the indicator of an intelligent agency, and many of you have heard me talk in multiple forums as to why I do not consider that a valid item, because information is a deeper principle which can be generated by more than an intelligent agent. So we won't go into that tonight again. But the other aspect here is what Walter has brought in, and which is a higher level of causality, because you're looking at relationships of a large number of what could be individually mechanistic items, but they're balanced in such an integrative way. I mean, all the different universal constants, even if you might think of one as being possible, but when you see the entire orchestration of all of them together, and they all have to be precise in this way, this is what Walter says, moves it to a different level, as to a level of agency as opposed to mechanism. And I'm saying, no, I don't think that's fair. You know, that doesn't really move it out of this mode of saying there is no scientific explanation here, and therefore we have a theistic explanation. Why not? We don't have any way of relating cosmological constants to intelligent agencies of any kind. And so we really do not have a basis to make that kind of relationship. To me, my own opinion, and you're probably all divided on that, is that it really takes it back into the realm of we do not understand how it all comes together, and therefore it's evidence for the existence of God. So, what I'm saying then is that if science is agnostic, you know, that you really do not look at scientific ignorance, you know, as evidence for the existence of God. So, if science is agnostic, you must ask me, why am I then a theist? Why am I a Christian theist? Okay. And I would simply say this, that I do not find my theology in science, but I find science in my theology. I'm intrigued by the fact that the monotheistic doctrine of creation still represents the best rationale for the existence and the comprehensibility of the universe. So, through faith in God as creator, we come to God through faith and not by science. But, as we get through God, we understand why there would be a set of cosmological constants and a universe, and it makes for a coherent explanation. That, in my opinion, does not constitute evidence from the cosmological constants to God, but it's more from God to the cosmological constants. So I would submit to you that scientific comprehensibility is a much better evidence for the existence of God than scientific ignorance. And I think we need to apply that in our daily lives, where God's action is seen not just in those things that we don't understand. Oh, how could this possibly have happened? Boy, that was God. God is in everything. Why do we limit God to just those rare things, or maybe not so rare, but the occasional things that we don't understand. As Christians, our faith is in a God who created and sustains everything. Everything is in God. And so this is how we see our science in the theology rather than the other way around. So let me just close by quoting C.S. Lewis, who said in his article, Is Theology Poetry?, where he says, I believe in Christianity as I believe in the risen sun. Not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. Thank you.